Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. They ain't gonna be in there. But 51% of your prisoners will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Blacks won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourselves up. I told you that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control buildings and industry, and put that pulls in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for a lease. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folks got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations who got the money. That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor then is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk own and control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. So you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't even communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisoners in the United States are black people. You only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate them. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March for what? Who cares? Marching has never changed anything.
Yeah.
many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But, man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, shoot it! So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles, the kid no one would pick, was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
Now learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. This God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said, this man that went to heaven, he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and it was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it. Just go ahead. So he kept walking. He messed around. He saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know? He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he said, nah, I won't know what's in the door. He said, you sure you won't see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had nothing but shelves on it. And then the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings, all of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him. And then you felt like you wasn't worthy. And so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room. And I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me. And I said, I want you to do this graph for me. And that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what you're having is, when God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it because your package going to go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on not meant to be way, because your package is going to keep going right on by. Because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt, I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go on pity way, your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off, because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box gonna get sent back to sender. And now you're gonna have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad a chap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit. And it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin if he will come.
Every once in a while, I like to do a string of videos that honor the brave men and women who fought against slavery in the Americas. This can certainly be a difficult portion of our history to discuss, but again, I think it's an important one to remember because we're certainly the product of survivors. So today, I wanted to talk about an African who not only stood up to Spanish slavers, but he was ultimately successful in creating a sovereign region, defeating them at every turn. What up, African world? It's Holmes here, and welcome back to another video of African history, culture, and worldview. By supporting this channel on Patreon, you're helping in the creation of these videos and supporting this content. If you'd like access to full courses and sources, or you simply want to show your support, you may do so by clicking the Patreon link in the description box below. It's unfortunate that this man is not more well known in the African diaspora. In fact, many people don't even know that enslaved Africans were also in the region he was taken. Today, we'll be talking about Gaspar Yanga, and how he formed a Maroon community of former enslaved Africans in Mexico. The significance of this is that we only know of one successful rebellion of enslaved Africans in Haiti, which went on to form a lasting state. But we don't know that another successful rebellion took place centuries before Haiti in Mexico. The story of Gaspar Yanga is a pride to people of African descent all around the world. How he was able to form a sovereign region within Mexico during the height of Spanish power in the 16th century is absolutely remarkable. The state of Veracruz, Mexico is known for its beauty and its very large concentration of Afro-Mexicans. The state contains a hidden jewel, a city that is both important to Mexican and African diaspora history. Yanga, affectionately called the Cradle of Liberty, is considered to be the oldest free black town in the Americas. Located in the eastern part of the state, the city of Yanga was also among the first independent towns to be formed in Mexico. It was established as a free black town on January 6, 1609. The town was originally named San Lorenzo de los Negros, in honor of the saint who devoted his life to uplifting peoples of African descent and other oppressed peoples. Its name was later changed to San Lorenzo Sarabalvo and finally Yanga in 1932, and we have the hero Gaspar Yanga to thank for that. The story of Gaspar Yanga begins in the 16th century when the enslavement of Africans by the Spanish was in its beginning stages. Gaspar Yanga was reportedly descended from a royal family in the Central African country of Gabon. He was brought to Mexico sometime in the mid to late 16th century and immediately began planning a revolt. One can only imagine that his royal status influenced his decision to seek freedom. Gaspar's righteous rebellion began in Veracruz, Mexico in 1570. The enormous mountain peaks behind the Veracruz lowlands became the home of both African and Indian Maroons in that time period. Established in Orizaba, the Maroon settlement had 60 dwellings with 80 men and more than 24 women and several children. The settlement survived by raiding provisions from the passing Spanish caravans, but they also farmed and raised livestock. What I find interesting is that Gaspar Yanga, with his knowledge of African statehood, formed and organized his new settlement based on his Central African government back home. The system was no doubt hierarchical. It concerned itself with self-defense and retaliation. The Maroons planted corn, squash, tobacco, and other crops in large fields. They also maintained animal husbandry for meat. The settlement continued to grow as more and more Africans were inspired by their hero. Gaspar Yanga had firmly led and established a new settlement in Mexico, and the Africans in the region honored him greatly in their loyalty to him and the settlement. As Yanga grew older, he gave military control to his Angolan war captain, Francisco de la Matiza. Yanga handled the everyday affairs of the town and took on the role of religious leader, retaining some of his own religious tradition from Gabon. The town entered a period of unrest when Yanga had a Spanish captive write and deliver a letter to his pursuers. In the letter, Yanga condemned the Spaniards for their cruelty and their cowardice, and dared them to defeat him. The released captive, knowing the location of the settlement, led the Spaniards to the colony. Along with his general, Gaspar's military prowess was undeniable. After 9 years of intermittent battle, the Spaniards were unsuccessful in capturing him and his men, but more importantly, they were unsuccessful in laying to waste his settlement. The Spaniards even attempted to starve out the settlement by targeting crops and water supply, but the Africans and their native allies moved deeper into the forest. In the end, Gaspar was able to form and sign a very favorable treaty with the Spanish, perhaps due to a combination of lacking funds and the military acumen of Gaspar's jungle warfare. The Spanish ultimately decided to accept the sovereignty of his Maroon settlement. This was a pretty momentous occasion in history because it had never been done in the Americas. It was the first time a European power submitted in full to the objectives of an African in the New World. The Spanish recognized, sanctioned, and guaranteed Gaspar's territory by law. Today, over 20,000 people reside in the city of Yanga, and a larger-than-life statue of the great liberator, Gaspar Yanga, stands today in Mexico. Gaspar Yanga's determination for freedom really reveals the importance of knowing who you are and your value. His royal status in Africa, accompanied by his knowledge of self, could not be undone by the perils of the gun or the sword. Well, I'm all out, guys. If you like these videos and want to help in this continued production, consider supporting the home team on patreon.com. The link is in the description box below. Know thyself. Remember your ancestors. Peace.
For virtually all of the known history of Homo sapiens, humans were known to have enslaved other human members of other groups, and this is a near universal trait seen in virtually every culture throughout all continents without fail. And it's even possible that our stronger, smarter cousins, the Neanderthal, might have been enslaved by early humans, as it has been found that female Neanderthal lineages can be seen in modern humans, although male Neanderthal lineages cannot. Of course, most people already know that the vast, vast majority of slaves sold from sub-Saharan Africa were not exported to the United States of America, with the bulk that crossed the Atlantic landing all over Latin America, so much that in the present day, the majority of the population of many Latino countries such as the Dominican Republic and Brazil have at least some African ancestry. And in fact, there are about the same number of self-identified blacks in Latin America as there are in the United States, as I discussed in a video some time ago. But in American curriculum, we are told many stories about the toiling work of slaves and a few daring stories of escape, but not really much else, and it would probably come as a surprise to many that although by and large the overwhelming majority of escaped black slaves in the southern U.S. made their way north where they would gain sanctuary, with some even making it as far as Canada, out of blacks that had gained their own freedom by barter, favors, or simply getting lucky and being released in a slave owner's will, many remained in the South. Shockingly enough, in 1860, out of nearly 500,000 free blacks in the U.S., 45% lived in southern states, with 15% of free blacks in the region owning slaves themselves. Although the bulk of this community were mulattoes of significant European heritage, many being nearly indistinguishable from other whites, yet because of the one-drop rule that instilled the strict racial dichotomy seen there, were considered colored in the United States Census. This rule is what largely helped these various communities of African or partial African descent to coalesce into a single ethnic population following the Emancipation Proclamation, falling under the umbrella category of black, which described not only the free people of color, Louisiana Creoles, a group which can largely fall under the former category, Gullah of the Carolinian coast, escaped slaves who had escaped north, and of course the roughly 3.5 million remaining blacks who had gained their freedom. The divisions between these groups are largely absent in the present day, with a couple exceptions, and most fall under mainstream American culture, but this is definitely not the case for other areas of the Americas, as of course Dominicans of mixed Spanish, Taino, and African descent would not consider themselves to be remotely similar to the Haitians lying on the western half of Hispaniola, although in Brazil, racial identification is far more fluid, being much more of a spectrum than any other country on earth, as many self-identified whites are less European than Pardos, and many Pardos are less European than blacks. Brazil, being the last country in the Western Hemisphere to abolish slavery, also has quite an interesting history with their various African descended populations. It is true that Brazil imported more African slaves than any other country in the Americas, with over 7 million crossing the Atlantic, and as a result, over 30% of the national gene pool is of African origin, as mentioned, with various groups having high variation, with even old stock colonial descended whites sitting at around 10%, and many slaves in Brazil had gained their freedom quite early on, such as during the Dutch-Portuguese War, wherein both the Portuguese and the Dutch employed a large number of African slaves, promising their freedom. Henrique Dias was the leader of the Afro-Brazilian regiment in the Northeast and loyal to the Portuguese during the war and up until his death in the 1600s, having traveled to Portugal in order to personally convince the crown to free the remaining enslaved men that served in the war. But rather than being freed due to displaying their loyalty and willingness to die for the crown, another group of free blacks who managed to escape began to develop in the northeast of Brazil, known as the Quilombola or Macambo, who came from many different tribes and nations throughout Africa, with a substantial percentage being Muslims. The Quilombolas incited several slave rebellions in northeast Brazil in the 17th century, which resulted in a great ire being directed towards them by the Portuguese officials, and the chief Quilombola settlement was raided, and the entirety of the community was believed to be killed or enslaved by the Portuguese and later the Brazilians. Fascinatingly, it was not until nearly three centuries later in the 1970s that it was discovered that the Quilombolas were not entirely eradicated as once thought, as a small group had escaped to the sparsely populated interior of Alagoas and other states in the Northeast, some having integrated with Amerindian villages, and others having established their own communities hidden in the jungles for generations, having a far more African-derived culture than other African-descended people of Brazil, and are treated much in the same regard as indigenous Brazilians in the present day. Another similar community in Latin America, where descendants of escaped slaves are for the most part known collectively as Maroons, were the Palenquero of northern Colombia, who similarly are the descendants of blacks who escaped slavery from cities on the Caribbean coast and fled further inland, creating the village of San Basilio de Palenque. And the Palenquero today speak a unique Creole form of Spanish, arguably the only form of Creole Spanish in the Americas, being heavily influenced by Amerindian and African languages. And outside of this, there were many, many cases of escaped black slaves integrating into Amerindian villages, just as there were in the United States to a lesser extent. So there were indeed Maroon communities and English-speaking British colonies. It was just with the United States having such a large white population and density compared to the West Indies, it was far more difficult for escaped slaves to actually form their own communities in secret, which was why the overwhelming majority, especially in the twilight years of the antebellum South, chose to trek north rather than stay put. The British West Indian colonies initially had white majorities, with the Irish being used en masse as indentured servants in Barbados and elsewhere, and in fact the majority of Afro-Caribbean populations from Anglo countries have at least some Irish ancestry in their heritage. But as the slave population increased higher and higher on the West Indian islands, more and more of the non-slave-owning whites of these islands decided to leave in kind, mostly to the United States, largely homogenizing them. This also came with the consequence of large-scale uproar and dissatisfaction among the plantation working slave population, outnumbering their masters 200-1 in some areas, and hence a large number of slave rebellions were set off across the Caribbean. Unfortunately for most, there really was nowhere to run on some of the smaller islands, but on Jamaica, Maroon communities had existed since before the British even took control of the island, a relic of slaves who had escaped to the mountainous interior from the Spaniards, and during the British conquest of the island, many more slaves fled to the mountains. So, as you can tell, although European colonial powers were never overly fond of these independent Maroon communities, thinking they might incite further slave rebellions or escapes, most were perfectly content with taking advantage of them and defeating common enemies, proving to be a thorn in the side for the Spanish Empire especially, seen with the English officer and explorer Sir Francis Drake, famous for circumnavigating the globe and discovering the Drake Passage. Drake was a bane to the Spanish Empire, pirating Spanish ships and plundering settlements in the Caribbean for years, making him a national hero in his home country of England. And Drake even personally visited and treated with several Maroon leaders in Central America in order to unilaterally combat the Spanish before dying of dysentery in Panama in 1596. In Jamaica, a large proportion of the interior was populated by Maroons, threatening the ever-growing population of black slaves and plantations all throughout the island, and a large group of Maroons and recently escaped slaves rebelled against the colonial authority, eventually being defeated, with a large number deported from Jamaica, either to the British colony of Sierra Leone, or all the way to Canada, where they helped form the Black Nova Scotian community. And although they never made up a particularly high percentage of the province's population in its history, peaking around 3%, it is the oldest African-descended population in the northeast of the North American continent. And they were, up until the 1960s, virtually the only major black population in Canada. The Windward Maroons, who remained neutral during the war, still do exist, however, living quite simple lifestyles with a culture very reminiscent of the African nations they derive from. However, by and large, the most noteworthy Maroon community today are the Guyanese Maroons in the territory of the Guyanas, namely the former British and Dutch territories of Guyana and Suriname, and the current French territory of Guyana. Early in the history of the Guyanas, the Dutch owned virtually all of this territory, although nearly all settlements were on the coast, with large plantations owned by Dutch and a few Portuguese planters, and when African slaves escaped, they trekked for miles deep into the Amazon rainforest, and although some attempted to return to Africa, for the most part, they accepted their fates and created secret villages loosely connected to one another, splintering into roughly six tribes over the centuries, with the Saramaccan and Induca being the largest. Now, unlike other Maroon groups, the Maroons of the Guyanas were never recaptured, conquered, or forced back into the general society, and the Dutch, realizing it wasn't exactly feasible or cost-efficient to launch a full-scale sweep through tens of thousands of miles of jungles, decided to treat with the Maroons, eventually reincorporating them into what would later become Suriname and French Guyana. These were villages of near full-blooded Africans transplanted to the continents of the Americas, and their culture and societies were very similar to that of Africa, having a comparable climate and landscape in the Caribbean region as West Central Africa, and they even adopted a unique script known as Afaka for transcribing their languages, Creole languages with extremely strong African influence. Numbering in the hundreds of thousands in the Guyanas today, around 20% in Suriname and 10% in French Guyana, Maroons have always considered themselves to be very ethnically and culturally distinct from others in the region, as unlike in the United States, there was no binary racial classification. Although due to recent missionary work, the majority of the community has adopted Christianity and is becoming increasingly integrated into these societies rather than being the de facto autonomous nation that they had always been. There are many other fascinating tales of the Maroons such as this, and I hope you learned something new from today's video. Be sure to let me know your thoughts on the Maroons and other free blacks of the Americas, and for today's poll, tell me which group of Maroons captured your attention the most. And as always, this has been Mason. Thank you so much for watching, and I'll see you next time.
Five 500 years ago, Europeans and Africans met for the first time on these shores. The encounter created the slave trade and changed the world. The slave trade remains a missing chapter in our history. Yet Britain led the world in the exploitation of human cargo. This story is not just one of slave raiding by Europeans, but slave trading by Africans. Greed led African kings to sell 12 million people across the ocean. This is not a tale of a trade which grew by accident, but one of a global business created by royal appointment.
The Royal African Company is to be incorporated to set to sea as many ships as shall be thought fitting for the buying, selling, and bartering of gold, silver, negroes, slaves.
Nor is it simply the story of passive, suffering negroes freed by heroic white crusaders, but one of black uprising. And above all, this is not a tale of a dead past. It still shapes the way Britons live today.
William Beckford and his father, Alderman Beckford, to put it bluntly, owned my ancestors.
It brings some Britons face to face with a heritage they've never before confronted.
My grandfather was what I'd consider probably a very charming man, and in his young days he was quite a dish. He really was.
And for the first time, Britons, black and white, discover a common ancestry.
Together we lead a
it's an ancestry rooted in a past when British ships carried African slaves. Bristol. This sleepy port was once a mercantile powerhouse which dominated the transatlantic slave trade. Ships that wrenched millions of Africans from their homes crowded the Avon for a century. Yet a visitor today sees a city stripped of any reminder of that cargo. Bristol has turned its back on the trade that made it rich.
I was simply amazed by the fact that there was no recognition that Bristol's wealth lay in the Atlantic trade. In vain I went to the museum, for example, to see whether there was a display there. Not a word of it. I looked at my university and saw whether anyone was teaching it. Not a bit of it. I talked to people in the street and they were completely ignorant of it. And I think that really in the 20th century, Bristol went through a long period of denial that there really was, as it were, a participation in this wider world.
The city's authorities have long resisted efforts, especially by the black communities, to mark its slave trading past.
There has been a genuine fear in Bristol of what the consequences would be if the truth were known. And part of the fear was generated, I think, was because the people who had the control over whether that history came out or not actually didn't know themselves what the extent and the nature of Bristol's involvement was. And I think it's more fear than denial.
But in early March this year, the first sign of change appeared. Bristol's dignitaries gathered for the opening of a new footbridge. It was a small step, but a victory for the campaign to commemorate one of the slaves who lived in Bristol. A man called Perro Jones.
We are here with our friends to show our respect to our ancestors who lived and died in this city as enslaved Africans. It's often not known that in 1725, Bristol alone enslaved 16,550 Africans in that one year.
It's the bridge that helps us come to terms with, to understand, and sometimes to confront a shared past, a past that contains for many of us great sadness.
This moment is a sign that Britain is waking up to its slave trading history. Perro Jones belonged to a Bristol family, the Pinneys. Britain's slave past does not start with Africa. It begins in 17th century England with the British Empire's first slaves, white men. The founder of the Pinney dynasty, Azariah, was farming in Dorset when he was swept up in a rebellion against the king.
The Duke of Monmouth landed in Lyme Regis in June 1685, and Azariah, probably tired of haymaking, saw these redcoats crossing the end of the field and thought that looked rather more fun than haymaking, and why don't I go and join them? And off he went. And in July of 1685, he fought the disastrous battle of Sedgemoor. The Duke of Monmouth was executed, and a very large number of others were executed too. Some were transported, and Azariah, my ancestor, was one of those lucky ones, being sent to the island of Nevis as an indented servant, which meant he was more or less a slave himself.
When Azariah Pinney landed, the island of Nevis was little more than untamed bush. The English convicts were put to work alongside native Indians and a few imported Africans. They cleared the island, first for tobacco, then for a new luxury crop, sugar.
At that time, the West Indies was something like a gold rush. There was this new chance to make quite a lot of money quite quickly, and a lot of people came out from this country to do it. And in fact, they employed Negroes imported from Africa as slaves, and they employed after the Battle of Sedgemoor quite a large number of white people who were indentured servants like Azar.
Azariah persuaded his sister to buy him out of servitude. Within a year, she had set him up in the sugar business. He quickly saw that convicts and Indians could not survive the harsh conditions, but his own time in the fields had shown him where the answer lay: Africa.
Large numbers of Negroes were shipped from Africa to the West Indies, and the African or the Negro population increased, and the white population decreased.
Within two generations, his heir, John Pinney, was meticulously recording the purchase of African slaves for his booming plantations, including one he named Pero Jones.
I desire you to take the earliest opportunity of buying me 10 new Negroes. Never let them be younger than 10 years, and never let them be as old as 30 if you can help it. Get them at St. Kitts or any other islands where they may be had best and cheapest.
His grandfather's enslavement probably made John Pinney uneasy about owning slaves, but the scriptures stilled his conscience.
I can assure you I was shocked at the first appearance of human flesh
exposed to sale. But surely God ordained them for the use and benefit of us. Otherwise his divine will would have been made manifest by some particular sign or token.
He was motivated by commerce. But in doing so, it seems that he regarded his slaves as his principal asset, and he looked after his asset. I flatter myself to say a word respecting the care of my slaves and stock. Your own good sense must tell you they are the sinews of a plantation and must claim your particular care
and attention. Humanity tempered with justice towards the former must ever be exercised. They surely deserve it, being the very means of our support.
They should be kept clean of ticks.
The demand for the Pinnish sugar was huge. To meet the demand, they needed more slaves, but they had to raise cash to buy those slaves. They turned to the merchants in the city of London for help. The money men were prepared to give loans to planters, but it was the higher profits from the slave ships that offered the best returns. The city wanted that business all to itself. The king was always ready to trade favours for cash. He granted a royal charter which gave a single London company, the Royal African Company, exclusive rights over the slave trade. In return, the royal family became its biggest shareholders.
Charles II, by the grace of God, King of England, Scotland, France, and Ireland. To all to whom these presents shall come, greeting. Whereas Guinea, Benin, Angola, and South Barbary, and the sole and only trade and traffic thereof, are the undoubted right of our heirs and successors, and whereas the trade of said regions is of great advantage to subjects of this kingdom. The Royal African Company is to be incorporated in the name of our dearest brother, James Duke of York, His Highness Prince Rupert, Anthony Earl of Shaftesbury, Henry Earl of Arlington, His Grace the Duke of Buckingham, John Earl of Bath. We hereby grant unto the same Royal African Company of England to set to sea as many ships as shall be thought fitting for the buying, selling, and bartering of gold, silver, negroes, slaves, goods, ware, and manufactures.
The company's men would let nothing stand in the way of their drive for profits. They already knew that slavery was widely practiced in West Africa. In most African nations, it was an alternative to a prison system.
Those who committed crimes, convicts, could be sold into slavery. If you owed a debt, you could be sold into slavery. Sometimes through deceit, or you could be tricked into slavery.
Slaves were also acquired as captives of Africa's wars. Europeans had long been part of an established system for bartering them.
The first Europeans who came to Ghana were the Portuguese, and they arrived in 1471. And when they got here, they found that there was a brisk trade in slaves between Ghana and its West African neighbors. And for 100 years, Portugal remained on the coast of Ghana and took part in this coastal trade, going to Senegal, bringing goods from Senegal, from Nigeria to Ghana, and bringing slaves in exchange for gold. And this was the situation before the transatlantic slave trade was introduced.
The Royal African Company had no interest in the coastal trade. They wanted slaves to ship across the Atlantic. They found a ready supply in local prisoners of war.
When you went to war and you defeated the people, you took captives home. So we decided what to do with the captives. How many slaves do we need for farming? How many do we need for the army? How many do we need for domestic work, etc., etc.? After they've gone through all those logistics, the excess goes through the Atlantic slave trade.
The image we have today of the slave trade as mass kidnapped by Europeans couldn't be further from the truth. For both sides, this was just business.
The African role in the transatlantic slave trade must not be swept under the carpet. The greed factor was there. Kingdoms made money. They rose as a result of the trade. Big, powerful people, rich families were created as a result of the Africans who were active collaborators in the trade.
The company found that African kings were just as greedy as England's own royal family. They were willing to supply exactly what the plantations needed.
The slave owners in the West Indies, they preferred slaves from the Gold Coast, because they said these were very hard-working, hardy slaves.
Local businesses sprang up to supply the transatlantic market. The European traders had no need to round up the slaves.
The Europeans themselves did not go inland to the villages or to the town to capture slaves. They remained at the forts and the castles. And it was the African traders, who sold the slaves to the Europeans. Now, what happened was that there were middlemen who would meet the inland traders bringing the slaves. They would buy these slaves and then in turn resold them to the European merchants in the castles.
Rival European powers were building castles to protect their cargoes. Within a century, there would be a fort every 3 miles on what used to be called the Gold Coast. It came to be known as the Slave Coast. The Royal African Company appealed to its major shareholder, James II. He began a string of garrisons, motivated possibly by the national interest, but more likely by his own profits. Every time a British ship was sighted, its sailors could rely on a welcome from the fort and from the African settlement next to it.
We took up our old anchorage opposite Cape Coast Castle and made arrangements for commencing our old business of gathering a cargo. Our first object is to lay in stocks of rice for the slaves on the passage to the West Indies. You will naturally think it must be difficult to transact business with these people from ignorance of their language. But they have been for so many years trading with the English that all the traders have broken English enough for the purpose.
The transatlantic slave trade dominated West Africa. For some kingdoms, selling slaves became an economic necessity. And all along the coast, new trading settlements were springing up.
In the 17th century, the Atlantic slave trade became the most important activity on the coast. We find that almost every town, coastal town, and almost every European fort and castle was involved in slave trading. So we have about 65 slave markets in Ghana alone.
The Africans could hardly have anticipated the consequences of all this, but the bargain they struck with the European slave traders transformed the continent. What started as a local tradition turned into a monster that eventually swallowed 12 million people.
Slavery existed in societies that had no prison systems. It was part of the punitive measures against criminal conduct, criminal behavior. The slaves lost their liberty. They went away, maybe into the neighboring state or the neighboring nation, but only for a season. It was not a long-term loss of liberty. And the children of the slaves, of course, were never slaves in that context. But here, of course, with the transatlantic slave trade, you have a final separation. People went away and they never came back.
Slavery would spirit millions away from the continent. It would be the cause of war and torment. And it would drag both Africa and Europe into a harsh new era. In the 18th century, the coastal towns of West Africa were making vast profits. But the price paid by Africans was enormous. The slaves were suffering treatment they had never endured before.
In the indigenous system, especially in Ghana, no slave owner had the power of life and death over the slave. But in the castle, you could do anything to the slave. You could kill the slave, you could maim the slave, you could mutilate the slave, you could punish the slave as you liked.
Cape Coast Castle in modern Ghana, the headquarters of the Royal African Company, a place of misery and terror.
They lived in the dungeons as though they were animals, you know, so they weren't given enough food to eat. They were prisoners. We have the condemned cell where turbulent slaves were kept. And a lot of them were turbulent because, I mean, if you live in your country and somebody comes out here and takes you into captivity, you wouldn't take kindly to that.
Slaves were packed into every space. They could be trapped here for months. There were only two ways out, to the sea and the slave ships, or to the graveyard.
They had to go to the bathroom in the dungeons. They were fed in the dungeons. Their whole life was in the dungeons, and that was very uncomfortable, very unhealthy. There could be some epidemics, no windows. They really were confined to those little rooms.
The forts became a byword for cruelty and rape. The Europeans' moral restraint evaporated under the African sun.
Most of the colonial officials who came onto the coast came without their wives. So most of them became mistresses. They doubled up as domestic servants, as mistresses, concubines for these officials. For some of the female slaves who lived in the dungeons, the governor saw, in inverted commas, some of the female slaves. And when they were found pregnant, if they were lucky, they were set free.
the Europeans had no shame about declaring their conquests. In Cape Coast, families still carry names like Gonzales, Coleman, Frith, and Da Silva.
You had the European merchants intermarrying or having African, local African women, and their offspring, called the mulattoes, also growing in number. As the slaves were brought in, not everybody was sold and shipped off. Some remained. And so one would see a kind of a cosmopolitan life growing along the coast.
The West Africans tolerated the traders' brutality because European military backing gave them power, and they needed to import cheap brass and iron tools for farming and cooking. The Africans were always hunting for a better deal. It was the small English town of Bristol which offered that deal. Local mineral deposits gave the city a unique advantage. Bristol could make high-grade metal goods cheaply. Factories spread across the Avon Valley to meet the new African demand.
This is what's known as a guinea pan that was used as one of the trade items that filled the Bristol merchant ships that sailed to West Africa. And for several of these, one could exchange a slave in the early part of the 18th century. And it was because these small factories on the Avon Valley were able to develop an industrial structure to manufacture these large quantities cheaply that basically Bristol was able to develop a slave trade in the early 18th century.
Bristol's golden age was dawning. The families who transformed the city used their wealth to buy huge estates. Abraham Elton's descendants still live in his stately home, Clevedon Court.
Well, he was very much a self-made man. He came from a rather humble background. He was apprenticed to a mariner and became a master mariner, but clearly had a strong entrepreneurial flair and finally became a merchant.
Abraham spotted the opportunities in metals. He bought land bearing extensive deposits of copper and began to search for new markets.
He was looking for an outlet for his copper products. He had the raw materials for the business, he had the copper works, he had an outlet with the Bristol brass industry for the copper, but naturally he was looking for wider markets.
Abraham's seafaring connections told him that Africans would pay good money for high-grade brass. He seized the opportunity.
A wide number of people were involved in stocking the slave ships. So something that seems completely unconnected to the slave trade, such as the brass industry, was actually very much geared to an export market to the West African coast, because West African warlords wanted brass pots. And so most of the brass pots were directed for what they called the Guinea trade.
Abraham was an aggressive cost cutter. He and others spotted that with a simple redesign, the ships that took their metal goods to Africa could also carry slaves to the Caribbean. They could then bring back sugar to England. At a stroke, their costs were slashed and their profits doubled. Their insight gave birth to the triangular trade.
What you tried to do was to fill your ships on the outward journey to Africa. You would then be paid for the slaves you took on the next leg of the journey, and then the third leg, bringing the sugar and the tobacco back and the rum back to Bristol, which you then sold on, so that you minimised as far as you could your financial risks.
The Bristol merchants had succeeded in surpassing the Royal African Company. They gave the African customers what they wanted at half the price.
It was not an exchange of unequals. It was an exchange of equals. One must remember that many of these African societies were very complex. They're very urban in places. Some of the cities were very large, and therefore they were not going to have shoddy European goods. So it required great skill in getting the right sorts of commodities. And the Bristol merchants in particular were very skilled at getting, bringing together these different items which were acceptable for trade.
Thank you. breakthrough in Bristol sent slave trade profits soaring. The city's restless merchants would use those profits to begin an historic shift in British life, the Industrial Revolution. Among Abraham Elton's circle of friends was Thomas Goldney, who had made a fortune from a single successful voyage. He ploughed some of the money into the work of an old family friend, Abraham Darby. Darby was experimenting with new ways of making high-grade iron goods. He moved his works to Shropshire, where he started to smelt iron with coke, a revolutionary process. The iron produced in Coalbrookdale was tough enough to make tools that would not bend or break. It opened the way to the modern age.
These experiments took place in 1709, and they're generally considered to be the point, the defining moment at which the Industrial Revolution begins. What developed was a remarkable partnership between the people who had the know-how on the one hand and the people who had the money on the other. What the Shropshire ironmasters were trying to do was to find a source of coke-fired bar iron that was acceptable to the African market. And it was this, to some extent, that inspired the industrial developments that took place.
The Goldney-Darby partnership also inspired Ironbridge, the cradle of the Industrial Revolution. This great leap forward is usually attributed to the native genius of British engineers, but it owed much to the demands of the African trade. By 1700, ships were pouring down the Severn Valley to Bristol, carrying goods destined for buyers on the West African coast.
To get a voyage to work, the merchants had to gather in commodities from the Bristol region. Many of these came from the Severn Valley, and it was the ability to get those commodities together that actually allowed the ships to trade with Africa and for the whole economies to work. So in some ways, the Industrial Revolution allowed the slave trade, the Atlantic slave trade, to be economically viable, to actually happen. Because without the Industrial Revolution, the commodities would have been too expensive and the African communities would not have been willing to trade.
In Africa, Bristol's iron was so valuable, it became a kind of currency.
Trade is all done on the principle of exchanging one piece of goods for another. All kinds of goods are priced by the number of bars of iron they're worth. Say, 4 muskets equal to 40 bars. Tobacco, beads and cloth, 20 bars. The total is more or less according to the value of the slave, so that supposing the bar is worth 1 shilling and 6 pence, these goods would purchase a slave worth about £9 sterling, which at present is about the price of a prime slave.
The sugar trade with Bristol had made Nevis rich, but it was a tedious backwater. John Pinney, now a successful sugar planter, longed to come home to Bristol.
The magic of the gold rush was over. A lot of people were coming back to this country and trying to bring money they'd made in Nevis or in other West Indies back to this country. And he was one of those too.
Pinney had built a great house, Mount Travis, on the island of Nevis, and acquired 13 sugar estates. His grandfather had been a convict. He was returning to Bristol the equivalent of a millionaire. But he didn't leave it all behind. As he sailed away from Nevis, he brought with him the ultimate status symbol of the prosperous West Indian planter, a slave he had named Pero Jones. Pero was separated from the last of his African family, his sisters Nancy and Shaba, when he set off for England, never to return. Pinney and Pero moved into a brand new house in Bristol.
He built the house that we're now sitting in. He acquired land in Somerset. He still had land and houses in Dorset. He continued in the sugar business, trading with the plantations in the West Indies, at a time when sugar was becoming increasingly part of the diet.
England probably seemed strange to Pero the African, but the sight of a black man was far from unusual in Bristol. Many merchants kept slaves as valets and housekeepers.
He may have started as a slave, but he is described as a servant or valet. And he looked after John Penny personally, one imagined mixing his, bringing his shaving water, setting out his clothes and so on. He was working for John Penny for 32 years.
On John Penny's return to Bristol, he found a city more interested in spending money than in making it. Complacency would cost Bristol dear. In 1794, the Bristol poet Romaine Thorne wrote an epic poem in praise of the city. It somehow neglected to mention the slave trade.
Majestic Bristol, to thy happy port prolific commerce makes its loved resort. Thy gallant ships with spacious sails unfurled waft to thy shore the treasures of the world.
The Docklands were the heartland of Bristol, and you had lovely residential houses being built just across the street from the warehouses by merchants who were all growing very grand by the 1720s and 30s from what was a pretty money-grubbing and hands-dirting trade. And then if you walk across to Queen Square, there were at least 8 African merchants in this square that was developed in the 1720s. It was one of the first provincial examples of what people have called the urban renaissance, you know, the beautiful Georgian explosion of houses and facilities in the urban center. And it was very much financed and driven by people directly involved in the slave trade. And the whole square was really peopled by those, not only in the Africa trade, but in the West India, Carolina, and Virginia trades. They were all in it. And these were the same people who, while they're shipping slaves from Mangola to St. Kitts in decks no higher than 4 foot 2 inches, they're also investing in the Theatre Royal. They're becoming patrons in banks. They're investing in the new private libraries. So you have this strange mixture of brutality and gentility that is just very much part and parcel of this triangular trade.
In Bristol, wealth bought respectability. The men who had made their fortunes from the slave business craved social recognition.
To be a trader or a merchant in the 18th century was still to have low status. You were still shown the back entrance, as it were. So that when you came into vast sums of money, which is what the slave merchants and the traders in slave-produced commodities acquired, you had to buy yourself into society. Now, the way to do that was simple. You had to build a mansion, a pile, hopefully in the neoclassical, neo-Palladian style, to show that you had learning or that you understood the classics. And then you had to patronize art.
Thomas Goldney was now one of Bristol's commercial aristocrats. He created an estate in the newly fashionable district of Clifton. The elegant veneer concealed the hard-nosed businessman.
In this garden is where essentially all Goldney's interests can be linked symbolically. Out here we have the harbour, where he could see the ships coming in, the slave ships going out, his commodities, his industrial goods coming down from Shropshire. He then arranges out some wonderful gardens, including over here a tower, which is in fact an engine house, which contained a steam engine, the type that was used to pump mines, which his investments up in Shropshire, the Coverdale Company, were producing. But he used it not to pump mines, but to pump his own water gardens, to recycle water backwards and forwards.
The splendour of the Goldney Estate had one main purpose, to impress Bristol's social elite. Beneath the garden, he built a grotto full of rare finds from his ventures in the South Seas and the West Indies. They thrilled his guests. Thomas Goldney, the grocer's son, was now a global player. The new rich of Bristol could leave the past behind very quickly. Goldney's friend, Abraham Elton, was now Sir Abraham.
His standing in Bristol was immense. He became mayor in 1710 and had his portrait painted wearing the scarlet robes. He became MP for Bristol, and he was so wealthy that he contributed £10,000 to the rather depleted coffers of George I. And as is usual with these things, he was, of course, made a baronet.
By the time he died, Sir Abraham hoped the family had buried its links to the slave business.
He'd amassed a fortune by his death of £100,000 in fair money. He was somebody like Richard Branson. He made a huge amount of money through his own entrepreneurial skills. I think anybody that comes from nothing and makes that kind of a fortune on their own skill, then as now, is extraordinary, is admirable in lots of ways. They weren't plantation owners, they weren't slavers. They were primarily concerned to export their goods to the widest possible market. And it seems to me, with the Elton family at any rate, the slaving part was just part of the cycle of trade.
For the next 100 years, good works became a passion with the Eltons.
The Elton that really got going with the development of Clevedon was the Reverend Sir Abraham, who was the fifth baronet. He put in the main drainage, the sewage, the gas works, he built the hospital. He was immensely concerned with the health of the town and, of course, of his estate workers. He built the churches, the schools. I'm very proud of that.
The foundations of this family's wealth are now obscured by 100 years of philanthropy, and across Bristol, the slave trade is virtually forgotten. In 1798, Perrow, the slave John Pinney had brought from Nevis, was dying.
All my family are well, except my servant, Perrow, who was very ill and now at Ashton for a change of air. I much doubt his recovery. One or other of us visit him 3 or 4 times a week. He has waited upon my person upwards of 32 years.
And I cannot help feeling much for him. Notwithstanding, he has not lately conducted himself as well as I could have wished. Pinney sent him to Long Ashton, just outside Bristol, where he convalesced, but then sadly died. And there is rather a charming, almost an obituary, of saying how much he had come to know and to like him. Then there's a sting in the tale, even though at the end of his days he died of drunkenness. But still, he starts off by speaking well of this servant.
Perrow did not psychologically survive once removed outside of his own black community. And basically, once he came to Bristol, he drank himself to death.
Perrow, I am sorry to inform you, died a few months ago, after being almost useless, caused by drunkenness and dissipation. Almost ever since we left Nevis in 1794, his conduct has been very reprehensible, insomuch that his mistress and every branch of my family have urged me to discharge him and send him back to Nevis with an annual allowance.
Perrow never made it back to his family in Nevis. The only records of his life are John Pinney's letters. But 200 years later, his name is commemorated by a bridge, a symbolic link between Bristol today and its slaving past.
And we reflect on the life of Perrow, the man after whom this bridge is named. Perrow, a black man, brought to a strange land in circumstances of servitude. So it gives me great pleasure to name this bridge Perrow's Bridge, to honor his memory, his name, and the struggle that he represented. Thank you.
By the time of Perrow's death, Bristol's gentlemanly traders had been ruthlessly pushed aside, there was a new pretender to the crown of England's leading slave port.
Well, Bristol's heyday in the slave trade, per se, was in the early 18th century, from 1698 till the 1740s, really. And then because she hadn't innovated the port to accommodate the larger ships, because there was a traditionalism about Bristol society, mercantile society, that was not as entrepreneurial, didn't seize the opportunities, as well as newer ports like Liverpool, we find that Liverpool eclipsed her by the mid-18th century and became much more important.
Location had made Bristol the master of the African trade. Location also proved the reason for its downfall. The Avon's retreating tide would regularly leave ships grounded on the mud. But the slave trade was expanding and needed bigger ships. Ambitious captains started to look for ports less awkward than Bristol.
It was a very difficult harbour to develop. And so really, effectively, Bristol squeezed out of the trade by the bigger, more profitable ships from Liverpool, rather than the rather smaller scale activity that Bristol merchants developed in the 18th century.
Bristol's dominance of the trade with Africa had come to an end. Its merchants had made fortunes and now moved on to other ventures. But their partners in West Africa had no such alternatives. The Africans were trapped in the business of selling people. A ship's captain could buy 100 slaves at a time in the Salaga market, and the demand from the plantations would not let up. African suppliers reached further inland. Raiding parties were now spiriting away thousands of slaves.
People intentionally raided and kidnapped people into slavery. It was not like that before the Atlantic slave trade was introduced, because you had enough for the indigenous system. You know, so why should I kidnap?
The traders hit upon a new strategy. Wars between African nations always meant captives for sale. So the slavers supplied arms to some nations and encouraged their kings to wage war on vulnerable neighbors.
When there was peace, it means there were no captives to be sold as slaves, and therefore the slave trade would tend to decline at that particular moment. And then when there were wars, then of course the captives would be brought, and then the slave trade would be flourishing. So in a way, or to a large extent, the slave trade depended, I think, heavily on the conflicts between the local African people.
The slave traders had started an arms race in Africa. They never gave any African nation enough weaponry to challenge European power, but the guns served to keep Africans fighting each other for a century. The years of conflict and depopulation left a legacy from which Africa has still not recovered.
Many people are saying, why talk about the slave trade? We want to forget about it. It was such a terrible crime against humanity. Millions of people were sent. Again, we can't tell the number. We could talk about the number game in history. Some say 10 million, some say 12, some say 20 million. Some even say 300 million Africans were sent away. And Africa was depopulated. And all these things happened. We are putting up with this right now.
The slave trade left an indelible mark on this part of Africa.
When I compared it with the Nazis, I think the world perhaps has not given sufficient attention to the fact that Africans had suffered a Holocaust before the Jews did.
What it does to me is just a sense of outrage, of just limitless anger. I think that our underdevelopment can be traced to this period, because by 1400, people who have also used iron and domesticated animals and started cereal development, rice and corn and such things,
We had no time to advance upon these. If you use the words of your most revered explorer, David Livingstone, commerce, civilization, and Christianity, the three C's. The first one we understand, trade. The slave trade itself was a commercial enterprise. I mean, the very forts that you will see on our coastline were not holiday resorts. They were holding pens for human beings. Then you talk of civilization. What kind of civilization were you talking about? Africa had civilizations. But because of the transatlantic slave trade, that civilization almost came to an abrupt end.
Africa was destined for a future of poverty and conflict. England's royal venture had reinvented the trade in human beings. And Caribbean planters were refining a brutal new system, plantation slavery.
Every once in a while, I like to do a string of videos that honor the brave men and women who fought against slavery in the Americas. This can certainly be a difficult portion of our history to discuss, but again, I think it's an important one to remember because we're certainly the product of survivors. So today, I wanted to talk about an African who not only stood up to Spanish slavers, but he was ultimately successful in creating a sovereign region, defeating them at every turn. What up, African world? It's Homesy Mir, and welcome back to another video of African history, culture, and worldview. By supporting this channel on Patreon, you're helping in the creation of these videos and supporting this content. If you'd like access to full courses and sources, or you simply want to show your support, you may do so by clicking the Patreon link in the description box below. It's unfortunate that this man is not more well known in the African diaspora. In fact, many people don't even know that enslaved Africans were also in the region he was taken. Today, we'll be talking about Gaspar Yanga and how he formed a Maroon community of former enslaved Africans in Mexico. The significance of this is that we only know of one successful rebellion of enslaved Africans in Haiti, which went on to form a lasting state. But we don't know that another successful rebellion took place centuries before Haiti in Mexico. The story of Gaspar Yanga is a pride to people of African descent all around the world. How he was able to form a sovereign region within Mexico during the height of Spanish power in the 16th century is absolutely remarkable. The state of Veracruz, Mexico is known for its beauty and its very large concentration of Afro-Mexicans. The state contains a hidden jewel, a city that is both important to Mexican and African diaspora history. Yanga, affectionately called the Cradle of Liberty, is considered to be the oldest free black town in the Americas. Located in the eastern part of the state, the city of Yanga was also among the first independent towns to be formed in Mexico. It was established as a free black town on January 6, 1609. The town was originally named San Lorenzo de los Negros in honor of the saint who devoted his life to uplifting peoples of African descent and other oppressed peoples. Its name was later changed to San Lorenzo Sarabavo and finally Yanga in 1932, and we have the hero Gaspar Yanga to thank for that. The story of Gaspar Yanga begins in the 16th century when the enslavement of Africans by the Spanish was in its beginning stages. Gaspar Yanga was reportedly descended from a royal family in the Central African country of Gabon. He was brought to Mexico sometime in the mid to late 16th century and immediately began planning a revolt. One can only imagine that his royal status influenced his decision to seek freedom. Gaspar's righteous rebellion began in Veracruz, Mexico in 1570. The enormous mountain peaks behind the Veracruz lowlands became the home of both African and Indian Maroons in that time period. Established in Orizaba, the Maroon settlement had 60 dwellings with 80 men and more than 24 women and several children. The settlement survived by raiding provisions from the passing Spanish caravans, but they also farmed and raised livestock. What I find interesting is that Gaspar Yanga, with his knowledge of African statehood, formed and organized his new settlement based on his Central African government back home. The system was no doubt hierarchical. It concerned itself with self-defense and retaliation. The Maroons planted corn, squash, tobacco, and other crops in large fields. They also maintained animal husbandry for meat. The settlement continued to grow as more and more Africans were inspired by their hero. Gaspar Yanga had firmly led and established a new settlement in Mexico, and the Africans in the region honored him greatly in their loyalty to him and the settlement. As Yanga grew older, he gave military control to his Angolan war captain, Francisco de la Matiza. Yanga handled the everyday affairs of the town and took on the role of religious leader, retaining some of his own religious tradition from Gabon. The town entered a period of unrest when Yanga had a Spanish captive write and deliver a letter to his pursuers. In the letter, Yanga condemned the Spaniards for their cruelty and their cowardice, and dared them to defeat him. The released captive, knowing the location of the settlement, led the Spaniards to the colony. Along with his general, Gaspar's military prowess was undeniable. After 9 years of intermittent battle, the Spaniards were unsuccessful in capturing him and his men, but more importantly, they were unsuccessful in laying to waste his settlement. The Spaniards even attempted to starve out the settlement by targeting crops and water supply, but the Africans and their native allies moved deeper into the forest. In the end, Gaspar was able to form and sign a very favorable treaty with the Spanish, perhaps due to a combination of lacking funds and the military acumen of Gaspar's jungle warfare. The Spanish ultimately decided to accept the sovereignty of his Maroon settlement. This was a pretty momentous occasion in history because it had never been done in the Americas. It was the first time a European power submitted in full to the objectives of an African in the New World. The Spanish recognized, sanctioned, and guaranteed Gaspar's territory by law. Today, over 20,000 people reside in the city of Yanga, and a larger-than-life statue of the great liberator, Gaspar Yanga, stands today in Mexico. Gaspar Yanga's determination for freedom really reveals the importance of knowing who you are and your value. His royal status in Africa, accompanied by his knowledge of self, could not be undone by the perils of the gun or the sword. Well, I'm all out, guys. If you like these videos and want to help in this continued production, consider supporting the home team on Patreon.com. The link is in the description box below. Know thyself. Remember your ancestors. Peace.
All right, boards running kind of slow today. All right, today's podcast is titled Successful Slave Revolts and Gaspar Yanga Patriot. I don't know about most, but some people, when you ask them how many slave revolts were they, you might get an answer of none, or you might get an answer of one. The one might be, Haitian, what I call the Haitian Revolution, where the slaves basically beat up on the French and sent them running, and they went from slaves to ruling themselves. The only former slave, well, when you're talking to most people, slave nation in the Western Hemisphere, former slave nation, not former slave nation, that's not the right way to put it, where slaves rose up and took over and have their own republic, Haiti. Now, before the Haitian Revolution, there was, let me put out some definitions here. Because once again, the title of the podcast is Successful Slave Revolts and Gaspar Younger Patriot. So, going to the dictionary, the word rebel is defined in, I have this in the program notes on Blog Talk Radio. Rebel, definition, a person who opposes a person or group in authority, period. Also, a rebel is a person who does not obey the rules or accept the normal standards of behavior such as dress, etc., etc. That's the definition of rebel. Revolt, definition. Put an end to the authority of a person or body by rebelling. Definition of revolt. And patriot is a person who loves his or her country and is ready to boldly support and defend it. I'm going to put a little tweak to the word patriot because it could be a person who loves his or her territory or freedom and is ready to boldly support and defend their freedom and or their liberty. I think those definitions are very important on hopefully people can see that there are different distinctions of what a slave revolt might look like. Most people, when they think of, particularly when the people that believe that there was no successful slave revolts, because you got quite a few people that think that. And we're talking about in the United States or Western Hemisphere. You have to know what those definitions are, but the way they look at it, a lot of people that believe that, is they go by the example of Nat Turner. Nat Turner led a slave rebellion or revolt, and it was not successful. It was not successful. Now, if we go to, and that's the standard. That's the standard that many people go by, the Nat Turner example. Now, the other example where there was victory would be the Haitian Revolution, what I call the Haitian Revolution, where the slaves revolted against the so-called powers that be, the French and Haiti at that time. They won, and then they took set up their own government in Haiti. So the common denominator on both of those was slaves rose up and had a physical or armed confrontation. In the case of Nat Turner, they were defeated. In the case of the Haitian Revolution, they were revolutionary. I mean, they were victorious with armed, using the armed confrontation strategy. All right. But once again, now let's go back to this definition here. Revolt, an attempt to put an end to the authority of a person or body by rebelling. The definition of a rebel a person who opposes a person or group in authority, a person who does not obey the rules. All right. There are different ways that you can rebel against authority without being armed. And that's what I think a lot of people, particularly when it comes to this, you know, there were no successful slave revolts in the United States. You don't have to fight somebody with your fists or rebel against, or revolt against somebody with your fists or getting arms or whatever. A very common way that people rebelled or revolted was they simply ran away. Some did it by individual means. Some people did it in very small groups. If you take a look at the Maroon culture, and Maroons essentially were Africans. I'm not even going to call slaves. Africans who somebody attempted to enslave them, and they rebelled. I mean, many Maroon communities were started right out the gate when that ship landed. They escaped. They weren't sitting at the bottom of the boat. You know, they were thinking, they were planning. So you have several Maroon communities throughout the Americas who strategy, they escaped once they hit dry land, and many of them set up their own Maroon communities. You got Maroon communities that were set up in what we call now North America, which is the United States. In the Caribbean, you have Maroon communities. In Jamaica, the Dominican Republic, Haiti, St. Kitts, Nevis, their primary way of revolt was hit the ground running. And that strategy worked out well for many of them. South America as well. So there are many different ways in which a so-called slave or a person that was called a slave could successfully revolt. Now, Gaspar Younger, and let me trying to line up. Okay. Gaspar Younger, let me read about him. I'm calling him, I'm not calling him a slave. I'm calling him a patriot. All right, because a lot of times the exact same thing he did, if he was white, you call him a patriot, but since he's dark, you call him a slave or a former slave. But anyway, let me read something about him. We've covered him with him before. Gaspar Younger, May 14, 1545, not sure of his death of transition date, was an African, I'm going to call him an African patriot, who led a Maroon colony. All right. Now, let me read the definition of Maroon here. Maroons are descendants of Africans in the Americas who formed settlements. In other words, settlements, towns, colonies, whatever you want to call it, away from slavery. How did they do it? They primarily revolted. They often mixed with the indigenous people, eventually evolving into separate Creole cultures such as the Garifuna and Muscogos. Let's see. In the New World, as early as 1512, enslaved Africans escaped from Spanish captors and either joined and escaped from Spanish captors. That's a revolt. It didn't necessarily that they had to beat somebody's ass first and then take over the ship. They sent, once again, they're different ways. What's that expression? They're different ways to skin a cat. All right. And either join indigenous people or eked out a living on their own. They had that skill set. St. Francis Drake enlisted several Cimarrones during his raids on the Spanish. As early as 1655, escaped Africans formed their communities in inland Jamaica, and by the 18th century, Nannytown and other villages began to fight for independent recognition. When runaway blacks and Amerindians banded together and we're talking about people who successfully revolted and subsisted independently, they were called Maroons. On the Caribbean islands, they formed. See, you know, this is another reason why I don't watch slave movies. Because slave movies, the primary slave movies that come out of Hollywood, always portrays us in a victimhood mode. Why don't they do a movie on Queen Nanny? Because there are many examples of Maroons who started their own communities. But anyway, there's quite a bit of information on here. They were in Dominica. We're talking about Maroons. The Maroons were successful in escaping or revolting against their captors. Dominica, St. Lucia, St. Vincent, practically every island in the Caribbean. The Dominican Republic, Haiti, Jamaica, Central America, including Guatemala, Belize, Honduras, Nicaragua, Panama, that's all Central America there. And North America, Mexico, let me read about him. Gaspar Yanga was an African leader, and you can sort of say he was African, I was going to throw Mexico in here, but African leader of a Maroon colony in the Veracruz Highlands, what is now known as Mexico. In 1609, after having been a fugitive for 38 years, Yanga negotiated with Spanish colonists to establish a self-ruled Maroon settlement called San Lorenzo de los Negros, renamed Yanga. That town exists to this day. Nova Scotia, Illinois, you got Lakeview, Illinois. Lakeview in Illinois was established by a freedman, by a group of African-American runaway slaves. You know what? By a group of African runaway patriots and freedmen who immigrated to from North Carolina and shortly thereafter, after the War of 1812, they arrived between 1818 and 1820. This area was ideal for the remaining Native Americans who lived, hunted, fished, farmed in this region, and the black community immigrated with the natives. Florida Maroons escaped, when they talk about black Seminoles, Maroons escaped from British colonists, and you know what? Escape was their form of revolt. And once again, look up the definition. That's why I read the definition of the word revolt. An ally with Seminole Indians, were the largest and most successful Maroon communities in what is now called Florida due to more rights and freedoms granted by the Spanish Empire. Some intermarried and were culturally Seminole. Others maintained more of an African culture. Descendants of those were removed with the Seminole to Indian territory in the 1830s and recognized as black Seminoles. Many were formerly part of a Seminole nation of Oklahoma, but have been excluded since the late 20th century by new membership rules requiring proving Native American descendants from historic documents. In New Orleans, New Orleans, South America, Brazil, Colombia, Venezuela, Ecuador, French Guiana, Suriname, all in the Indian Ocean as well. So there were several, we can probably spend a whole month on this topic, which just letting you know we're not. And but there were many of them. We will cover it some more. Tomorrow we're going to get into Black Wall Street, but we're not going to cover it from the aspect of there were several Black Wall Streets. In any event, we'll be back in a couple of minutes.